We're going to go ahead and see about calling ourselves to order. And I'm sure you're wondering why I'm talking here instead of our normal leaders. So I'm Naomi. I'm the chair of the Equity and Access Subcommittee. And unfortunately, our chair and our vice chair had urgent issues that they had to attend to today and could not make it. And so I was asked to guide us through our day today. And Randy Kinman, the vice chair of the Equity Access Committee, is here as well and is going to help me keep track of everyone and make sure that we keep ourselves going forward. So thank you for being here. So our first item is the approval of the September 12th, 2012 meeting minutes.
Move approval.
Okay, thank you. Are there any amendments or discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstain? I'm going to abstain, actually.
Oh, okay.
Since I wasn't here. Okay, thank you very much. So our next item is public comment on items not on the agenda. I don't have any cards. Are there any public members hiding under seats or anything? I don't see anyone. So we will move past that then, and we'll go on to our next item, which is the subcommittee reports from the Equity Access Subcommittee, and I actually asked Randy to speak to this.
The Equity and Access Subcommittee didn't meet today. We took today off, and the Regional Equity Working Group met and went through the TIP analysis that this body saw in July. And it's kind of in reference as to how we fold everything into the One Bay Area plan. And the general consensus is it doesn't matter how many sets of data you have. We're never happy with the data that we have. That was the meeting.
But we keep looking. Thank you. Okay, so our next item is an action item. It's the Policy Advisory Council 2012-2013 work plan. This committee met last month with the commission to develop this work plan, and so it is summarized in your packet and with a number of topics and specific descriptions underneath, and there's also a nice calendar table that describes our year, and of course it is subject to change and adjustment as we go forward, but we were hoping that this committee could go ahead and approve this work plan for the year. So are there any questions?
Yeah, on point number two in the overall recommendations, I think we may have landed on meeting as necessary, but wasn't semi-annual or every 6 months thrown around? Was there agreement on that? Did we want to set that?
I do know that the commission chair, Tissier, did ask for you to touch back again in 6 months. For us, it was sort of unclear if she was asking for you to meet every 6 months or if she was saying, hey, let's meet again in 6 months. So I know because of their schedule with adopting the plan, we thought it was better to just say, we're going to meet again. And we'll try to fit it within that six-month schedule, and, you know, as the commission's timetable allows us to do that.
Anna?
Sorry I wasn't here in September. I just wanted to ask a clarifying question around the Plan Bay Area item on the work plan. I see that PDA readiness and feasibility study is on here, and just wanted to get some clarification. Is this review of what all the local CMAs are doing? Because I know for our county, VTA is going through a process to determine that. So was this regional review of those individual plans?
Okay. I'm looking to Pam. I wasn't here either.
Well, you would ask that one. You know, I do know that it is a study that's just getting started, so in terms of detail, I don't know that I can tell you much, but it is just getting started at this point. So we know it's coming up, and so that's why we put it on here. What came from the work plan meeting from both the commission and the council members was that you wanted to know, and the commission wanted to know, what's coming up on the discussion, and so we might not always know all the details, but we put it on here anyway. So,
okay. Well, I was glad to see it. I'm very curious. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I see Dolores.
We had talked about, and I may be confused about where it was that we were talking about doing it, but learning a little bit more about the consolidation of transit agencies and being able to understand that a little bit better. And I don't know that there's anything we could do about it, but I think I personally think it would be better if we did understand a little bit more about how that's impossible and how that's possible to do. And what, anyway, that was something. Weren't we talking about that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think Kathleen's got it right. It is under the heading of TSP. And I think what we like to do is have these broader subject topics and then fit your individual items underneath that. So it is definitely under the TSP as a follow-up.
Okay. Carlos?
I think on another topic, which I think we brought up, and I don't know if it's actually, I don't see it here in this write-up, was the effect of pricing. I don't know if it's been kind of put into social equity, but there's just this whole effort right now where there's pricing strategies that MTC is looking at, and I think this body should be reviewing and before any decisions are made and providing advice on that.
So again, what we were attempting to do is give what this chart does and what the narrative does is talk about things that we believe will come up in the next year. So in terms of pricing, the Express Lane network is on here. That's the one item that we could foresee that would likely be under a larger discussion for the commission. So it is on here as a separate item, but we didn't put pricing on as a general topic because really it's related to the Express Lane network at this point in time. So you tell me what.
Just a follow-up on, I think there was this VMT pricing that the commission's been kind of reviewing over the last few months, and that's different than the Express Lane, I think.
Right, and in our minds, that would come up under the Plan Bay Area as they're talking about implementation and what strategies they might use to get to greenhouse gas reduction. It would come up under that discussion.
Okay, Randy?
I think it's pretty fair to say that what this represents is what we all agreed in the room we were pretty sure was going to come up over the next year, and it didn't preclude us from adding to the work plan as other items came up. Or there's always that surprise when you start unwrapping things, like, oh, we didn't think about that. So it doesn't preclude us from addressing any of those things.
Okay. Other comments or questions? Okay, would somebody like to make a motion?
Move approval.
Wait. Who's the second?
I think it was Jim.
Jim?
Yes.
Okay.
Now okay. You can have discussion.
Oh, yes. More discussion?
Sorry. Yes, one quickly. And I may just be missing it, so if it's under one of these larger headers, Pam, just let me know. But the Regional Prosperity Plan and the HUD grant... Is that under equity more
so,
broadly?
Again, we're looking at what we talked about were things that the commission's going to be taking up. So if you want to get involved with that process, we plan to let you know when those meetings will be so that you can stay involved. It's not an MTC-only project, so it wouldn't necessarily be coming to the commission for approval in that sense.
Okay, other discussion? Okay, shall we call the question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all in favor of the work plan?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstain? Okay, we have a work plan unanimously. Thank you. Okay, so our next item is the MAP 21 overview, which is being presented to us by Rebecca Long. So You have the floor. Can you turn on your microphone? Thank you.
Thank you. Rebecca Long, Senior Legislative Analyst here at MTC, and I'm just going to walk you through an overview of MAP 21, the new federal authorization bill. This is just a two-year bill. It covers fiscal year 13 and 14. It also covered a few months in fiscal year 12, but we're already into fiscal year 13 now. So I'm just going to go over a few of these different items, talk about the consolidation of programs, elimination of earmarks, cuts to active transportation funds, performance measures, project delivery streamlining, expansion of TIFIA, although I think that might have fallen out of this presentation. We'll see. And loosening of toll restrictions, and finally talk a little bit about the missed opportunities. Okay.
What does MAP stand for?
Oh, okay. Good question. Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century. And I can talk about some of these other acronyms here. So for the last 20 years or so, Congress has been enacting multi-year bills for federal transportation. And when you can see there, in it doesn't have the date, but ICE-T was a very significant one, passed in the early 90s, and it was a $26.3 billion annual funding level, and it lasted, I believe, 6 years. You can see the successor to ICE-T, which was T21, stood for Transportation Equity Act in the 21st century, was a big increase in funding. That was also a six-year bill. Then we went to SAFE-T, enacted in, say, 2013, so it was around 2007 or so, was also a 5 to 6 year bill. And you can see that between SAFE-T and MAP 21, basically we saw no bump, no increase in funding. It's you know, at the margins. For fiscal year 14, there's a slight increase that essentially tries to provide a ability to keep pace with inflation. But relative to prior acts, it's really keeping us at just flat funding. And this is, you know, quite significant in terms of, you know, setting a new potentially disturbing trend. And it as far as the why, you know, we can get into this more in the Q&A afterwards. But the bottom line is that the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which funds federal transportation, is basically funded by the gas tax, and it's running at a significant deficit. And so the only way that they've been able to keep funding steady is through transfers from the general fund, which of course increases the deficit. And under this Congress and in this economy, there's, you know, very little support for increasing the deficit. So even to get this level funding that we saw in MAP 21 required a significant infusion of general fund dollars. So until we solve the bigger crisis of how to fund the Federal Highway Trust Fund, we're likely to see federal money stay essentially flat or decline. And in many respects, you know, this was considered quite a victory to even just keep funding level compared to some of the earlier proposals. For example, in the House, the leadership proposed a 30% cut to transportation, which is essentially what you would see if they stopped transferring funds from the general fund. If we were just going to fund federal transportation based on the user fees, it would be a 30% cut. So this just provides a little context on what those increases were. It was a 37% increase from ICE-T to T21, 40% from T21 to SAFE-T. And as I mentioned, we're really barely keeping pace. And the other notable difference with MAP 21 is that it's just a two-year bill. So, you know, it took significant effort to even get the bill done, and it really doesn't provide much of a long-term structure. And this was noted in by many folks that it's not really big long-term solution. The Wall Street Journal noted that it was relied on a remarkable array of budget gimmicks voters aren't supposed to notice, and you know, I would venture to say probably many didn't. And even Senator Orrin Hatch noted that the revenue title basically kicks the can down the road. But of course, nobody wanted to confront the obvious solution, which would be raising the gas tax, and that's pretty much been off the table in Washington and in Sacramento for almost 20 years now. Just some more detail on how they did reach the funding levels that they were ultimately able to provide in MAP 21. It relies upon a $21 billion in transfers from the general fund and also the leaking underground storage tank fund. It also includes some pretty questionable math, including counting 10 years of savings from pension fund stabilization for a two-year bill. So they're kind of bringing forward, you know, anticipated savings just to pencil things out. So big picture in terms of the policy changes in the bill, I'd say one of the principal themes is consolidation of programs.
I'm sorry, just a second. Fred, do you have a clarifying question?
I don't mean to jump ahead, and you may be addressing this, but all these numbers become further clouded with regards to the fiscal cliff in about a month and a half or so relative to the federal budget and rescissions. Will you be addressing that, or can you say anything relative to what this all means to any of the numbers you've just mentioned with regards to MAP 21?
I'm happy to speak to that now. Fortunately, since federal transportation is largely funded by, you know, dedicated user fees and is considered mandatory spending as opposed to discretionary spending, we're largely unaffected by that fiscal cliff. There is some funding that's considered discretionary. Unfortunately, it would include federal transit administration funding for capital investment grants and some other programs, but it's about $700 million of the total, so it's not a huge amount of funding that would affect transportation. Was there another question? Okay. So as I was mentioning, one of the big changes in MAP 21 is program consolidation. There were, you know, at least 60 separate highway programs under safety, and MAP 21 consolidates them into about six core programs. They're not, for the most part, big changes from the earlier programs. So even under safety, there were the big programs, and most of them remain. But what's happened is all these smaller, you know, sort of special interest programs, modally specific programs for some small type of project have been lumped together into these broader programs in order to, you know, really simplify the program and make it more focused on core national interests. So the new programs are listed there. One of the new names that you might notice is the Transportation Alternatives Program. I'll speak to that a little bit later, but that's a consolidated program. We used to have a program called Transportation Enhancements, and now that's been eliminated and turned into the Transportation Alternatives Program, which also subsumed some other programs. Another interesting change, which I wouldn't necessarily say is a positive one, is that the formula factors that determined how much each state received from these different programs have been eliminated. So prior to MAP 21 under SAFE-T, just take STP as an example, Surface Transportation Program, California's share was related to how much congestion we have, how much our population is, and those types of things. Now there's just a calculation done for how much did each state receive overall under in fiscal year 2012 under SAFE-T, and then they get that same amount. And then you split up the different programs in proportion to, you know, what the bill requires. So just as an example, the National Highway Performance Program, every state has to spend, I don't remember the percent off the top of my head, but let's say it's 30%. So it's just not driven anymore by need, which is kind of ironic because, as I'll talk about a little bit later, the bill does bring in this concept of performance measures into the program, but they haven't quite linked together. You know, you're going to do performance-based planning and try to track how you're doing, but your money isn't really tied in yet to what your performance is. So hopefully that will be done after MAP 21 in fiscal year 15. Transit program is also consolidated quite a bit. The elderly and disabled program is merged with the new Freedom program, and it actually is increased overall. So those programs combined were about $226 million in fiscal year 12, and now it's gone up as this new program to $258 million. Is there a question?
Yeah, just could you just give a thumbnail, just your best guess of what that will do if there are increases to the paratransit programs in the Bay Area? Very important.
To the paratransit programs? I'm going to turn to Anne to answer that question.
Good afternoon. I'm Anne Richmond with MTC staff. I work on several of the transit funding programs. And the 5310 and New Freedom programs generally have not funded the transit operators' paratransit expenses. Those are funded through a few of the state sources and then local operating funds. So while there's definitely an opportunity to perhaps try some new things under this combined 5310 and New Freedom program, it will be largely for activities that are outside of kind of the standard paratransit operations. There are no guidelines yet from FTA on this program or really on any of the new programs, so we'll have to wait a little bit and kind of see what some of the parameters are.
If we could limit our questions to clarifying questions related to the slides, because I think we're going to have plenty of time to ask our questions after. But if you do want to be put on the list, just raise your hand. I saw Dolores, and we'll put you on the list to get as soon as the presentation's done. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. That was going to be my guess, but I didn't want to just hazard a guess. The JARC program has also been eliminated. That was the Job Access and Reverse Commute program. That started out as a discretionary program in T21. Then it was turned into a formula-based program. It was focused on providing, you know, transportation options for low-income communities, trying to address welfare to work, mobility gaps, and that type of thing. So it's been eliminated now as a standalone program, but the types of projects that were eligible under JARC are now eligible under the largest federal transit formula program, which is federal FTA Section 5307. So, you know, on the one hand, it's not a dedicated pot of money, but now the largest share of transit funding is fully eligible for those types of projects. In addition, the amount of funding that regions receive under 5307 is partially determined on the basis of each region's share of low-income population. So the more need you have in that regard, the more funding you'll receive. There's also a new program known as the State of Good Repair Program that replaces the Fixed Guideway Rail Modernization Program. Really, in terms of the purpose of that program, it's largely the same, focused on rehabilitation of rail systems, and also the underlying formula provides, fortunately, roughly the same amount of funding to the Bay Area, which is about 8% of the national total. The bus and bus facilities program, that was a discretionary program. It wasn't a very large program, but many Bay Area operators did compete for those funds and did request earmarks from that pot of money. It was often earmarked in Congress. On occasion, it was administered through the administration through a competitive program, but it did turn into pretty much a earmarked program. That has now been turned into a formula program, and so Bay Area operators will receive a guaranteed 4%, which, you know, is always nice to have some predictability. I'm not going to walk through this, but it shows you in a nutshell what I've been describing as far as consolidation. So this is the consolidation on the highway side, similar consolidation, a little bit less dramatic on the transit side. One of the other really significant changes of Map 21 is it contains no earmarks. Considering that Safe T contained about 5,600 individual earmarks, totaling $22 billion, this is a major change and one certainly for the better. And it's also notable that's one way that they were able to keep funding level is by shifting the funding that had traditionally gone into earmarks into the formula programs. And so now when you look at the overall funding for MAP 21, 93% of the dollars are distributed by formula compared to 83% under Safe T. And what that means is that, you know, each state and each region is able to have more predictability and not spend as much of their resources chasing after small pots of money in Washington and just getting on with their work. It also tends to favor both California and the Bay Area because unlike some parts of the state, you know, we have a lot of population, we have a lot of transit riders, so we tend to do well under formula programs. For some folks who might, you know, have success politically but not really have those underlying factors in their favor, they might have preferred the sweepstakes. But for us, we tend to do better when it turns to formula. One of the things you might have read in the paper with regard to Map 21, probably the area where it got the most criticism, was that it does eliminate some of the dedicated programs for active transportation funding and the like. So the Safe Routes to School program, which was a standalone program, was eliminated. However, it remains as an eligible category within this new program, the Transportation Alternatives Program, known as the TAP program. In addition, the recreational trails program, that was its own program, that's now sort of subsumed under the TAP program. So overall, if you look at, you know, what were the dedicated funds under Safe T and what are they now for bicycle and pedestrian types of projects, it's about a 33% cut in dedicated funding for those modes. On the other hand, the STP program, Surface Transportation Program, that we receive a significant amount of as a direct sub-allocation from the state is also eligible for these types of projects. So it's not as if this cut in dedicated funding is going to result in necessarily a 33% cut in funding for those types of projects, but it leaves more discretion to states and to local agencies.
Randy has a clarifying question.
I have a clarifying question on the recreational trails. Does that include urban bicycle routes that could be considered recreation because they're generally run along, say, rail lines or things like that, but that they're actually used as alternative roadways?
I believe the recreational trail program does fund, they don't need to be in sort of rural areas. They could be urban trails, but they do need to be dedicated and off of the main roadway. So certainly a rails to trails type of project would be eligible. And I should note that the recreational trails did slightly better than the Safe Routes to School program in that it's now funded as sort of a set-aside within the TAP program. So it's still dedicated. It's still going to receive a certain amount of funding within California. It just doesn't have its own special pot of money. Moving on to performance measures and goals. So the bill sets national goals for these following categories: safety, infrastructure condition, congestion, system reliability, environmental sustainability, freight movement, and reduced delay of project delivery. It also creates a very complicated process that you can see just by the sheer fact of how many bullets there are. This is about as concise as I could make it in the process that's going to be developed to establish these performance measures. So, you know, big picture, the bill says, you know, we aim to improve safety, we aim to reduce traffic congestion, et cetera, and then it The DOT secretary is required to establish more specific performance measures by April 1st, 2014. There will be a comment period of 90 days. Then within a year of that, each state is going to adopt its own performance targets. So it's kind of similar in some ways to SB 375, for those of you who are familiar with that, where the regions were able to recommend targets of greenhouse gas emission reductions to the state. In the way this is going the opposite direction, it's federal down to state and then ultimately down to regions. But the state targets will be a lot more specific than those enacted at the federal level. And then once California adopts its performance targets, we will have 6 months to turn around regional targets that have to conform to the greatest extent possible, which I think are going to be words we return to quite a bit once we get to that point. And clearly, you know, the regional agencies are going to want to be very engaged with Caltrans in the development of the state's targets to make sure that our hands aren't tied and that the state is, you know, going in the right direction, since we have to conform to those targets. There will be progress reports required on these targets with each update to the RTP as well as the TIP. And within 4 years, states will be required to report on their performance. So as I mentioned at the outset, you know, the bill is innovative in bringing performance measures into the program, but how it's all going to ultimately shake out, how it's going to affect funding, I think really remains to be seen, because these, as you can see, a lot of these years are way outside even of the time frame of MAP 21, and Congress could come in, you know, in 2015 and scrap the whole thing. I doubt they'll do that. I think this is kind of the industry direction, but there's still a lot of open question about what this will all mean. Here's just some details that you're not expected to read, but this is a list of all of the different deadlines for action in the bill by different administrative agencies. project delivery, this is a topic that certainly has been around a lot in Sacramento and in Washington. The bill, I would say, this is another sort of example of kind of a partisan issue and how they ultimately reached some compromise on this. Certainly, members of the House and Republican leadership were pushing strongly for, you know, major streamlining of the process under the National Environmental Policy Act. So that's the federal equivalent of our CEQA. And they did ultimately reach some agreements that I hopefully will be significant. One of them is that any federally funded project with less than $5 million in federal funds is essentially exempt from federal environmental review. It doesn't mean it's exempt from CEQA, but it doesn't need to go through the duplicative NEPA process. Additionally, project sponsors are allowed to move forward with acquisition of right-of-way before completing the environmental review. So that's often been a concern that, you know, the process is so sequential that, you know, if you clearly know where you plan to develop this project, even if you want to proceed at your own risk in terms of, you know, not knowing yet if the federal government will approve your environmental document, you should at least be allowed and not punished for purchasing that land if, at the end of the day, they approve your project. So this is just saying, if you've bought the land and if we ultimately agree that that's a reasonable project and we approve it environmentally, you can be reimbursed with federal funds. Right now, you cannot do any expenditure for right-of-way and expect a reimbursement if you do it prior to the finalization of the environmental document. There's also, this was kind of interesting, clearly a result of compromise. So I think the Republican version of the bill in the House set some firm deadlines on how long environmental agencies had to review projects. So, for example, you know, if you don't turn a permit around within 6 months, it's deemed approved. That was not accepted by the Senate. So what remains in the bill is basically a process where the project sponsor can request to sit down with the person they're negotiating with at the federal agency and come up with agreed upon deadlines. So collectively you agree this is our time frame, and then if the federal agency misses those deadlines, there are actually financial penalties that the agency can be subject to. Up to 8% of their budget can be eliminated. So kind of an interesting way to bring in kind of private sector incentives into the public process. We'll see how that goes. Tolling provisions. Clearly, tolling is one of the only lights on the horizon as far as new funding, and the bill does broaden authority to toll within the federal interstate system. However, it's only permitted if you are keeping the same number of toll-free lanes intact. So, for example, you could widen a freeway, an interstate freeway, and those new lanes can be tolled, but the existing free lanes cannot be tolled. There's one exception to this, and that is if you're reconstructing or rehabilitating either a toll bridge or a tunnel, you can toll the existing lanes. And so one of my first questions to FHWA during the webinars is, how exactly do you define reconstruction and rehabilitation? But they haven't answered that quite yet. There also are some penalties, a little bit more teeth added to the law with respect to maintaining the speeds of HOV lanes. I don't know how many of you have driven on I-80 during the peak, but sometimes the carpool lane is just as slow as the mixed flow lanes, so it's not really providing a lot of incentive to carpool. Well, there's really not much punishment or penalty that Caltrans or the FHWA imposes right now for that deterioration in service. Under MAP 21, there's sort of much more teeth in that, and so the hope is that by kind of forcing the issue that you need to maintain a higher level of service in HOV lanes, it will help prod folks to convert to hot lanes, because if you take the I-80 corridor as an example, clearly going to a 4-plus occupancy would be very difficult, but if you were able to do that while converting to a hot lane, at least you're still providing a decent level of usage of the lane. I think the fear would be if you convert to 4-plus, all of a sudden nobody's using the lane, and that would be deemed as a significant waste. So by monitoring the service, you're encouraging more use of pricing.
Clarifying
just a minor thing on that. Under sort of the federal guidance on that, would it ever be explored to do not an increase in the number of occupants required, but an increase in the number of lanes with no change in occupancy? So like 2-3-person travel lanes?
So dedicating another existing lane to... That's interesting. The way the law is written, it doesn't explore that. It does talk about considering elimination of, you know, other types of vehicles that are permitted, for example, low-emission vehicles and that type of thing. But, yeah, it doesn't speak to conversion of existing lanes, which I think the real obstacle there would be public acceptance, for one, but also just Caltrans policy. Well, there's no restriction on it in the law. For practical purposes, you know, California doesn't do that. So bottom line, what does the bill mean for the Bay Area? CMAQ funding is actually cut nationwide by about 5%. That doesn't sound like very much, but, you know, every penny counts these days. And so that is a hit to our region. The STP program, while it grows 14% nationwide, the share going to metro areas that's sub-allocated actually decreases from 62.5% to 50%. That was a significant loss that we thought wasn't going to hurt so badly, because the original version of MAP 21 increased STP by such a large extent that it didn't matter. We were still doing better, but at the end of the day, it is a hit compared to where we thought we were going to be on STP. So we've seen certainly a hit on both of those programs. Overall, when you compare our highway estimates with highway funding estimates with what the bill delivers, it's about $32 million lower over the 2 years of fiscal year 13 and 14 combined. We have reached some agreement for fiscal year 2013 with Caltrans and CTC on funding for just for that year that increases the STP share slightly. And so, you know, there is some flexibility within the state about how to distribute this funding, and so we'll be working again next year in Sacramento to further increase the share going to regions. On the transit side, it's generally better news. It's a slight increase in funding, not significant, but I'd say we're basically held harmless on the transit side. Big picture, missed opportunities. There's no solution to the long-term funding crisis. It's just kind of staring us in the face as we approach 2014. One of our big pitches in Washington was that they should create a metro mobility program. The national commission that Executive Director Steve Heminger served on made a big pitch for focusing the federal transportation program on core national priorities, one of which certainly should be, you know, metro mobility, given that the vast majority of Americans live in metro areas and how important they are to the economy. But the bill, in a way, went in the opposite direction by reducing the share of funding going to urbanized areas being distributed by population in that STP formula, which in a way is our the only program that today serves as a metro program. So it kind of went in the wrong direction in that regard. And then there was no funding for a national freight program. The bill does create some national freight goals, which is progress, and it establishes an Office of National Freight Strategy within the administration, but it's more just lip service than funding, but there's no money, so that's not to be expected right now. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, so on our list, we actually have Rich first. Okay, and so then Dolores.
I thought paratransit was an unfunded mandate.
I think many transit operators would probably agree with you. Yeah, paratransit is a requirement, and there is no dedicated funding source for paratransit. Yeah, but this bill doesn't make any changes to that. Yeah.
Okay, Kathleen was next.
Two questions, both on the kind of new reporting requirements, but then also on the idea of kind of a Metro Mobility Commission. Is there an effort, or will it be part of MTC's Ledge platform or something, to align those with things like the national partnership, like the HUD, EPA, DOT, Sustainable Communities Partnership, because I think there's a lot of performance measures being developed out of those that would speak to kind of cross impacts. Just looking at some of what would be reported, seems like it would touch on those things.
Absolutely. I think those are the types of criteria that would be considered. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a second question?
I'd like to see it informing that effort, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else?
I had a question on the reporting.
Okay, Randy, and then Richard.
Yeah. So I had a question on the reporting. It's because it always makes me a little itchy when I see that we're setting goals that aren't defined, and then we're going to be reporting on how we achieved our goals. So it's the thought that from the federal level, we're coming out with this with a guideline, and then the states have to adopt something that is so each state gets to develop its own goals, and then each region within the state gets to develop its own. So everybody's devising their own different reporting formats so they can say, well, look, we achieved our goals.
To some extent, I think that's fair. I think the way to think about it is it's getting more and more specific as it goes down from the national level to the state level and then to the regional level. So the national standards are going to tell us, in general, what areas we need to be focusing on. The state standards will actually adopt specific goals for the state of California. And then based on those state goals, the regions will adopt specific, you know, numerical goals that make sense for each region. And then as far as reporting requirements, you know, the states will report to FHWA on how they're doing, and we will report presumably to Caltrans and, for that matter, to the federal agencies on how we're doing.
Okay. Richard first.
Yeah, I was also looking at the Metropolitan Mobility Program part, you know, especially the, you know, I was just thinking how, you know, like our committee, the Equity and Access Committee, would probably come into it, and whether it would be feasible for, you know, for the Policy Advisory Committee or the Equity and Access Committee to maybe kind of take a stab at this, and, you know, once the state figures out what they're going to do on that level, then it comes down to us, you know, and the timeline and so on.
I think maybe you're suggesting that the Policy Advisory Committee weigh in on the development of the regional performance targets. Yeah, I think that would certainly be, I mean, it's going to be a process. We have 6 months to develop those targets, and I'm sure they'll be vetted, you know, publicly and with the commission and here. So we've got a few years before we have to worry about that.
Rich?
Yeah, in just broad generalities, it sounds to me from all of your very well reported information that transit did better and highways did worse. Highways, streets, and roads.
I'm having to reflect for a moment. You know, I think as a region, we did better in transit than we did in highways, but California actually received the exact same amount of funding in fiscal year 13 as they did in fiscal year 12. So it's more about how those funds, as I mentioned, there is some discretion within California about how the state distributes the funding, and because of the way the different formula programs were adjusted, so remember CMEQ was cut, and then STP gives us a lower share. So it's not that the state or, you know, nationally highways did worse than transit, but it's how much of that funding trickles down to the Bay Area. We lost out compared to how we were doing prior on highways. Yeah.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, do we have our next speaker? Oh, Rebecca, you're the next item too. Which is the MTC 2013 legislative program. So we are anxious to hear about that.
Okay, well, I'm really going to turn it back over to you because we don't have one yet. And that's why I'm here. I believe you all have wanted to, you know, have an opportunity to recommend ideas for the development of our legislative program. And so I believe this is the earliest that I've ever come to talk about it, which is great because we really are at the brainstorming stage right now of thinking about, you know, what items we should include in our LEG program. In fact, later this Friday, we're hosting a meeting with our partnership legislative committee, which is kind of an ad hoc group of all the legislative staff from, you know, the CMAs, the transit operators, advocates, you know, Transform, and various folks. Silicon Valley Leadership Group are invited to come, and we basically sit around the table and, you know, exchange ideas, hear what other organizations are thinking about, where we can partner, et cetera. So that is all to say we don't have a list of proposals right now, and I really am here to, you know, hear ideas from you all. In the memo, just to kind of help stimulate some ideas, I just highlighted some of the types of themes that, you know, we often focus on. So the four bullets down at the bottom, you know, are ways that you all might think of that we could encourage more transit-oriented development, perhaps find ways to improve the CEQA process. There's a lot of interest in that in Sacramento right now. There was a last-minute push on that at the end of the current legislative session. It fizzled out, but I think there will be opportunities there next year. You know, ways to improve bicycle and pedestrian safety, ways to reduce the combined cost of housing and transportation. I did note, you know, clearly revenue is always a priority and something that we always focus on, but in some respects, it's also, well, in many respects, it's the hardest nut to crack, and it's in some ways also only gotten harder with passage of Proposition 26 a couple years ago. Now, pretty much any local measure requires a two-thirds vote. And, you know, clearly we've pulled that off in the Bay Area with sales taxes, but it's not easy. So I just mentioned that to say, you know, I'm very open to hearing about revenue ideas, but we just have to be realistic about what we can get done, especially in Sacramento, where it takes a two-thirds vote as well. And at least up until now, we have not had a two-thirds vote in the legislature in support of tax increases. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Naomi.
Okay, so we're going to have a pretty open opportunity here to throw out ideas. And so our first is Rich, and if you want to get in on this, put your hand up so Randy can note you down.
Actually, you raised one of the issues. I'd be open to any ideas that people have here on CEQA reform for transit-oriented development. There are so many issues that go along with that. To get by lawsuits, oftentimes developers pay a lot of money to various groups in order to settle issues. I can give examples but won't. As long as there have been multiple studies over the years in those areas, the areas are known well, I see no reason to tie needed projects up with the type of CEQA that they're going through. Sometimes even the same project area where other projects have gone forward, done their CEQA, and then pulled away. So, yeah, there's got to be some give somewhere. And I think, actually, I don't want to speak for other organizations, so I won't, but I'll just say I've heard in some of the organization, environmental organization, some agreement that maybe some reform around TOD might be a good idea.
Kathleen?
One of the things that's been curious to me on the revenue generation side is people talking about, you know, what's going to replace redevelopment and tax increment financing. And I know that the two, or one, 1156 is one that I've heard about being tossed around in the last session. What concerns me is that all of the solutions that do seem to be coming forward don't seem to have a blight requirement anymore, that you actually be addressing blight. They're simply being put out as economic development tools. So I would be interested in anything that MTC supports or kind of examines, also look at, you know, the equity and the blight elements of what those districts should and could do.
Bennett was next.
So, yes, the leadership group, which I work for, is actually very, very interested and working very hard on CEQA reform. And we're looking at a variety of different things. But as Rich mentioned, it's really it's a political challenge to get any kind of CEQA reform passed in Sacramento. So if your organization is interested in working on this, please let me know. I'd love to connect you with the statewide coalition that is focused on this issue. And so obviously CEQA reform is a high priority for the leadership group. Another thing that we're looking at is the same idea that Kathleen brought up, this value capture mechanisms, some sort of way of replacing redevelopment. The leadership group actually supported a Steinberg bill this past year that took a look at that, but that bill never made it through the process. So we'd love to see MTC focus on those as well this year.
Okay, Wilbert was next.
No, he's passing Carlos.
Okay, Carlos.
I think I'm just echoing some of the other comments, and in regards to considering, you know, that we have SB 375 and the dissolution of the redevelopment agencies, making it that much harder to implement the at the local level. So I think MTC should be tracking and trying to put its resources into seeing if we can get some traction there, like the Steinberg bill that didn't make it. And then I guess also in terms of reducing the costs of transportation and housing, just from the development side, I think the one thing you want to consider is how much can local jurisdictions do to kind of prime the pump for development, housing development, and also commercial development. I think we shouldn't discount that. I think that's important. Getting transportation access to jobs is really important. So it could be partly the streamlining of CEQA and maybe some other things that local jurisdictions need to put in place to maybe do a little bit more of the upfront entitlement work and preparing the land for development. So I think I don't have any particular bill that I'm thinking of, but something along those lines of trying to maybe have cities and local agencies like BART and that may have some land that they actually do look at how to more effectively make that marketable so that we can have these opportunities, particularly for affordable housing and as well as, you know, other development. But I think affordable housing is now part of the equation here too. So I think that we need to look at those opportunities.
Okay, Rich had a follow-up.
Now, one other idea follows the below market or the density bonus that developers get if they include below market rate housing. A lot of the communities where I live have very, very strict density rules, and this helps a great deal. I would say that we need to desperately look at a height bonus in transit-oriented development within at least a half mile, if not a PDA, of a station, which would be, with under certain requirements, could not be set aside by a local jurisdiction. That's the way we get more housing density and get more riders on transit. There's actually, in my city, various organizations now, even from neighborhood groups, are talking about targeted areas in the city where they want to raise the height limits. And that is a breath of fresh air for me.
Can I just ask a follow-up on that, Rich? So the density bonus, in practice, the way that works is it doesn't sort of exempt you from the height limits? Is that true?
No, you can't do any extra height if you have a density bonus.
Interesting. Yeah, I always assumed that it did. No. So that's a very good idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer, you know, and it comes from I'm sorry, I hadn't thought of it earlier. It comes from the whole idea of if you have one type of bonus, why not have another one? And that would actually solve, if we could do that at the legislative basis, some of the areas we're talking about in San Mateo trying to raise those height limits.
And stop a huge, ugly political fight.
Kathleen?
I'm also getting at the housing transportation cost. I know that parking cash out seems to come up and be kind of on the platform regularly. Is just general parking reform or parking pricing guidance?
Absolutely. We've had that on our Ledge program for some time. We're actually hosting an event in November. If any of you are interested in, it's going to be with basically on the subject of AB 904, the Skinner bill that was introduced kind of late in the session. It was really similar to a bill she attempted the year before that also died. But essentially what it tries to do is put a limit on the amount of parking that a local city or county can require a developer create as off-street parking for housing that's or commercial development near transit hubs. So it's only in transit-intensive areas. And it's always takes a little bit of time to explain, and it tends to really draw huge local opposition. So the League of Cities opposed it, CSAC opposed it, but it's important to point out that it doesn't cap the amount of parking that a developer can provide. It's really trying to say, free market, you figure it out. The city can only require one off-street parking space per unit within these areas. If the developer thinks the market needs more than that, they can do it. It's not a maximum. It's just putting a cap on how much the government can mandate. So that's the bill that will be discussed. And it's really, this workshop is an attempt to bring folks together and really try to find some more common ground and find a pathway forward. It even had a lot of exceptions in it that, you know, if a city made a finding that for whatever reason they really couldn't follow this, you know, they could opt out of it. But even with that, it was still opposed. So hopefully we can make some progress on that, but that's definitely on our radar.
I would just recommend reintroducing the Give Me Three legislation that Brown just vetoed for the second time about safe passing distance for bicyclists.
Okay.
Okay, so Randy was next, actually.
Thank you. I have a couple of them here. And my first comment is we have things like the HOV lanes, which have fees on them that are not enforceable at this point. So I just want to be clear that when we're talking about future legislation that that has some type of a fee or a where we expect to generate, we actually have a way of collecting that. Because right now I can travel down 680 going home and be in the HOV lane and nobody's there to tell me I can't be. And so I just want to make sure that when we look at new legislation, we actually have a way of going from point A to point Z on that. I kind of lost track of where we stood on the auto dealership license plates because of our bridge tolls. So that... Where do we stand on that?
Well, it's a good question. We worked on a bill that we actually didn't support, but in some ways we helped stimulate this bill by raising this issue in the legislature, and then in a way the bill got hijacked by the New Car Dealers Association. And so some reform has happened. Basically, effective July of this year, as a result of the passage of this bill, it was AB 1215, passed in 2011. Now, if you go and buy a new car, you're required to register that vehicle automatically, so through an electronic process at the dealership. And what that means is that the process of getting the plates to the new car owner is way faster. It's gone from about 3 months to a couple weeks. The problem is that the onus of putting the plate on the vehicle is still with the vehicle owner. And so, you know, if for whatever reason you're lazy, you have figured out that nobody will pull you over and you can sort of get away with it driving around without a plate, there are still going to be those scofflaws out there. And so we haven't really addressed that piece of the problem. I think the challenge now is that since that piece of reform just went through and just went into effect, it's going to be hard to make a case to kind of revisit this this quickly. I've actually just asked our fast track folks to give me a report on, you know, how this has changed since this just went into effect in July. It's going to be a little early to really tell, but see if we see any reduction in the number of violations of vehicles without plates. So that's where that is right now. The challenge is that the New Car Dealers Association and the CHP have not been very supportive of the idea of moving to a temporary plate system, which would be the simplest way to go. So in a lot of states, as soon as you purchase the vehicle at the point of sale, you will get a temp tag. And as soon as you leave the lot, your vehicle will have an ID that ultimately becomes your permanent plate, that number. But it's complicated, you know, it can be costly. So we're not there yet, but it's still on our radar as a problem that needs to be solved at some point.
Thank you. That brings me to my next point, which was, I really don't know who our friendly people are. It's in Sacramento other than my local friendlies. So, that would be something good for us to have an overview as to what's going on up there, who's sponsoring what. Once we get through this election cycle and things settle down a lot. My last comment is on CEQA, and as somebody who has successfully used CEQA to block projects, I do not want us to be automatically on the bandwagon of supporting CEQA reform when the general public that uses CEQA as an appropriate and valuable tool is not involved in the process. So it's great, and I'm not banging on the leadership forum for this, but the bottom line was, as somebody who lives in Santa Clara Valley, who's been successful at this, and whose cases were good and solid, and they weren't NIMBY cases, and ultimately upheld, I want to make sure that we're not rushing to streamline to the point where we're rushing the public out of a public process. So I would be extremely interested in seeing us facilitate meetings that actually get everybody, because the minute people hear, and again, not bashing the leadership forum, because I think they're great, but when people hear that they were working on this and that we over here had nothing to do with it and weren't even notified, you create a conflict. So I don't want to see that happen. MTC has enough conflicts going on right now, so we don't ever need to dream up new ones. So being able to facilitate the conversation before we jump into something major like that, I think is an appropriate role for us to discuss in the legislative path. That's my 5 cents worth.
Thank you, Ad Dolores. So the next person on the list is me, actually. And so I wanted to note that in the last legislative program, we had some concern as a council and in our subcommittee first when there was an item added on between when we looked at the legislative program and when it was approved, mm-hmm. which was on disabled parking reform. Mm-hmm. And so I did want to touch on the items of related to that I think are good to pursue, which is increases in fines for parking illegally, and also trying to work with the DMV to relook at the issuing process, because I think there's a lot that could be looked at or cleaned up there. I think the ADA paratransit programs have a really good way of defining transportation issues that people have, whereas I think the DMV is just doing a very simple sort of checkoff process and issuing placards mm-hmm. very readily, and I'm not sure that they should be. So those are areas of reform that I think would be good mm-hmm. to pursue. Okay, next is Rich.
I wanted to bring up an issue I've been thinking about since we did talk a little bit about parking and TODs. I live in a very highly populated area of mixed use, retail, office, big employers, Gilead, Fisher Investments, Salesforce.com, Visa's world headquarters. One employer has done something that I think needs to be looked at as possibly a requirement of development within mixed use. When parking rules were set up for offices, it was a different type of office, a lot of file cabinets, a lot of space. Now you have almost twice with scanners and digital savings of documents. You have almost twice the employees in office buildings you used to have. So Salesforce.com has actually hired Peninsula Parking Services, and when their lot fills up, they require people to valet park, and they pay for it. There's no cost. And so that almost doubles their parking. Now, my suggestion would be to put that as a requirement. I'm going to speak. Actually, I'm going to Public Works tonight. I'm going to talk to the various agencies to start moving the ball in San Mateo on this. One of the biggest for surrounding neighborhoods you get is they'll be parking in front of my house. Mm-hmm. To some extent, that's true if you don't do things like this. So it would help the pushback on development, but also it would push them more towards, I won't say which company, but there's one company that just refuses. They do the shuttle and they do passes, but they refuse, because their HR manager told me this, to really lay it out to people and bang on them about using transit. And they make really good money and they have really nice BMWs and they like driving them, so they drive to work. So I think it would push employers, if they had this added expense, to maybe focusing a little bit more to get this down in their parking lot on transit. So, but it really is a great way to eliminate a neighborhood parking problem, mm-hmm. number one. Number two, and just to reply to CEQA, because I agree, I've used it myself. It's a great tool to keep Walmarts and other big boxes out of transitory developments. We actually have a developer that came and tried to build a Walmart at the Kmart by the Hayward BART station and ended up building 600 units of housing because we kept him out with the Walmart. So sometimes you can really use it positively. Mm-hmm. So my point on CEQA is very targeted CEQA changes.
Right. Dolores?
Yes. I was wondering, I can't remember how much money Fast Track loses a month. Is it $1 million or something like that with cars without licenses? It doesn't matter, but anyway, let's say it's $1 million.
It's not that much a month, no.
But could as a pilot program, could you fund the pilot program for these new car dealerships to get it started and put the money in to begin with so that then it gets going and then it actually, in the long run, you would
I think the concern, it's not so much a startup cost, it's an ongoing cost. Because if they went with a temp tag system, then they're going to need to be paying a company that, you know, creates the temp tag system. So it's an ongoing cost, and I don't think we want to be in the business of paying for that. Of paying for it. I mean, I think, yeah, at the end of the day, it would probably be a loss. It costs us about, I'm going to say about between $4 to $5 million we're losing in direct tolls. When you add on the penalties that we could be, you know, collecting from those violations, it's about $20 million or so. So it's not chump change, but I think the cost, yeah, I don't think we want to be in the business of paying the dealerships, nor do I know that we would even be allowed to using our funds, right? I mean, that would be a transfer of public money straight into the private sector.
I don't know. Maybe there's some way you could work it out. It seemed to me like it would average out somehow.
Possibly.
Okay. Oh, was there anyone else over on this side? Okay.
Linda? You know, I this may be a stupid idea, but if we're having the trouble with that, what would happen if we said you cannot go through the toll gates, except for in this particular lane, if you don't have plates, and they are required to stop and show that they have registration?
The problem is you can't enforce that. So the very reason right now that we have this problem is that our enforcement right now depends on cameras for the most part. And so if a vehicle goes through and they have no plate, then we can't capture them unless we have CHP or somebody, you know, standing by. So that's the problem.
Okay.
Carlos?
Okay. I at the risk of kind of trying to problem solve this temp tag, just something else to think about, because at least at a local level, the not having a plate has many different ramifications.
Yeah.
And so it's not just the toll collection. I think that it is a bigger societal gain if you can, I just say illegal, people do things illegally knowing they can get away with it when they don't have a tag.
Yep.
So I don't know how you frame it, but even getting down to like law enforcement officials, and there's probably more.
Trust me, I have pitched this to every single law enforcement association in California, and I have to say it's been quite discouraging that they haven't, you know, seen, as you point out, the public safety benefits and other things. I think it's just a real case of it's really hard to change the status quo. And one of the problems is that in other states that moved to temp tags, they had a paper-based temp tag system to begin with. And so there were efficiency gains to be had by moving to an automated system. We've never had a temp system. And so it's adding a new, you know, requirement that, you know, many folks feel like, well, we've just gotten along well enough. And toll agencies are the only ones that are sort of taking this direct financial hit. And we just haven't yet been able to sell law enforcement, you know, CHP and others on the merits of it. But trust me, we are trying.
The next time you go to San Jose and talk to San Jose PD, take me along, because they just spent, one officer did a sweep of my neighborhood, 6 blocks, and picked up and towed over a dozen stolen automobiles because I'm close to the freeway. They get parked by my house. The one in front of my house was a new car with temp tags on it. So it's, if I'm a thief, I'm going to steal the car that nobody has a license plate on because nobody's looking for
right.
it. So you take me to talk to Chief Moore or whoever's chief.
All right. It's a date.
Rich?
I know from being on a state board for 10 years that the computer system the state has is tremendously old. We actually can't talk to, we can't tell someone if they have fines before they renew their license to pay. And they can't renew their license until they pay their fines. We have to do that manually. We're trying to remedy that right now. It's costing us millions.
I just had that happen. Okay, I think we're done.
Okay. That looks like everything. Rebecca, can you tell us when we're going to hear the next update on this topic?
Absolutely. So November, we'll be coming back with the draft LEDGE program, and then that will also be going to our legislation committee in November. And then, you know, we continue to get feedback between the draft and the final. So that, you know, that is why changes can be made. I'm putting you on notice that, you know, just because we bring the draft to you again, there still might be changes between the draft and the final because, you know, we are soliciting input from our commissioners and others. But, you know, we will certainly try to keep you in the loop in that process. With respect to this disabled parking issue, since I know, you know, it is one of interest, we don't plan to try to tackle it this year. The reason that we added it last year was the city of San Francisco was considering putting it in their legislative program. I think they've kind of taken a step back from trying to do something in Sacramento next year, and they're starting a more kind of regional process, local process to really figure out what the best thing to do is, and we're going to participate in that process, but I don't think we'll see a bill on that subject in 2013.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for all the feedback.
Okay, so our next item is the staff liaison report from Pam.
Okay, well, you can see the items listed in your report, but I'll just draw your attention to some upcoming events. First, Rebecca mentioned the smart parking workshop that's going to be here at the Metro Center on November 9th, and I did put that in your report. There is a $10 fee to attend that, so just to let you know that. And you do need to register, so if you go to the MTC website, you can just follow the link in your packet or go to the MTC website to register for that. Also, note the next Business Outreach Committee event is scheduled for Thursday, October 25th. At the Caltrans offices in downtown Oakland, and there's a flyer that I've included in your packet on that as well. And Caltrans has scheduled bridge closures for the San Mateo Bridge, which I'm sure you've already heard about that, but just to make sure you plan accordingly for the last two weekends in October. And if you haven't had a chance yet to check out MTC's new Spare the Air Youth website, I would encourage you to do that. Sometimes it's the kids who teach the parents. So MTC is hoping to, I think, capitalize on that by focusing its efforts on educating kids on how they can play a part in helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So check that out. The web address is just sparetheairyouth.org, and let us know what you think. And finally, even though we didn't have an Equity and Access Subcommittee meeting this month, I wanted to note that the work on the update to the Regional Coordinated Plan is still ongoing. And MTC staff is looking into putting together an ad hoc group for a more in-depth discussion around that. That group is slated to include the Policy Advisory Council, as well as some commissioners and other key stakeholders. So stay tuned as staff provides you some more details on when that ad hoc group gets started. And that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, do you have a council member report? Okay.
Oh, no, I have a question on the staff report. I wanted to thank or to congratulate MTC for getting SB 1339 signed. That's the commute benefits bill that was just signed, I think, at the last days of the legislative session. I wanted to ask if it's been determined who will be administering this bill. As we move towards implementation, our members are very curious about how the process is going to roll out and want to participate.
I was wondering about that, too. I was thinking, gee, Rebecca's here. We should have asked her that during her presentation, so that's great.
The real answer is it isn't quite yet determined. So the bill authorizes both MTC and the Air District to move forward with this. Both agencies are required to adopt the ordinance. I think it's pretty clear in our mind that the Air District is going to be the enforcer, since that's more traditionally their role. They're a regulatory agency. What's still, you know, kind of up in the air is exactly how we will divide up the outreach, you know, and that type of thing. I think naturally 511 would have a big role in that. 511 has already has a database of about 20,000 employers, so we already – have a lot of experience working with employers, but you know, the Air District also does a lot of work on Spare the Air, and so that's something we're in discussions with them now on, and we really recognize the importance of having it be very clear, you know, to the public, to employers, so they're not kind of confused about where to go. So it's very important we get that right. And yeah, so we're working on that.
Thanks. Is there a staff person that I could talk to for more information to keep posted?
Sure. Radia Victor okay. is going to be the lead at MTC. And then at the Air District, I believe Dave Birch is going to be working on the drafting of the ordinance. I'm going to help with that as well. But in terms of the bigger picture, Radia is going to be the lead.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so now we're moving on to, do you have a question?
Not question, but council report.
Okay, council member report. So first, Linda.
Okay. I just wanted to let all of you know that I am very happy to say that
there we, go.
We have had the first scoping meeting for BART to Livermore. It has begun.
Okay, other reports? Things to share?
One more report. The leadership group is conducting a transit-oriented development tour in Santa Clara County on Saturday, October 27th. We'll be visiting some VTA light rail stations in Sunnyvale, North San Jose, and also downtown San Jose. So if you're interested in coming, we'd love to have you. I can send the details over to Pam to send out. Thanks.
Just an announcement, the Housing Leadership Council's annual housing day is at Oracle. It's meeting on the 26th. There will be a light breakfast included, as well as a very scrumptious lunch prepared at Oracle. A lot of good breakout meetings, a lot of good information. And best of all is that if you're in the East Bay, you can take BART to Hayward, get on the M bus, and ride right to the front door.
Oh, okay. And let me get Wilbert, and then Pam has something she needs to touch on.
Yeah, it's just FYI. Tomorrow will be a press conference for the Central Subway. The granting of the full fund grant agreement. Nancy Pelosi will be there with, along with the mayor, and they'll be at 1:30 right on Stockton Street, right off of Ellis and O'Farrell. On it. Yes, it is.
Okay, Rich?
That's wonderful. I just attended a meeting, actually two meetings, on the stationary plan for the Brisbane Caltrain station. It's going to move forward to where the light rail connects. You'll be able to get off Caltrain there and go, when that's done, and go all the way to North Beach from that station. It's just, you know, I probably won't see it in my lifetime, but just knowing it's going to happen is great.
Okay, I think Pam had something that she forgot to hit on the thing.
Yeah, you actually reminded me to remind you all that our biennial awards program is coming up in 2 weeks, and you are all invited. I'm sure that you all got the postcard, but I believe there's some more over on the table over there, so please make sure you take one of those to remind yourself. The event happens just before the commission meeting in October, so 2 weeks from today at about 8:30. The program will start promptly at 9 at Preservation Park here in Oakland. So you're all invited. Let me know if you plan to attend. I'd love to keep an eye out for you.
Jim, did you have an announcement? Okay. Anybody else? Okay. So our last item is new business. Does anybody have any new business for future discussion or future agendizing? Okay, seeing none, we will adjourn and see you next month. Thanks.
5 minutes early. 25, 35
yeah.
minutes.
We are really fast today.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I thought it could go that way.
Yeah, I think we had...